Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, November 11th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMED. In tonight's news, Food for People is hosting two emergency drive-through distributions on Thursday, November 13th. Berkeley Traffic Safety Platform Street Story surpasses 1,500 reports in Humboldt County. And events plan to promote community comment to undam the Eel River. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyon, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
On Thursday, November 13th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., Food for People will be holding two emergency drive-through food distributions in response to the delay in SNAP benefits during the government shutdown. They will be located in the parking lots of College of the Redwoods and the Hoopa Valley Food Distribution. Gabriel Zucker reports.
On Thursday, November 13th, Food for People, the food bank for Humboldt County, will be holding two emergency drive-through food distributions from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. This is in response to the delay in SNAP benefits during the government shutdown. The distribution will be located in the main parking lot at College of the Redwoods and the Hoopa Valley Food Distribution parking lot. Carly Robbins, the executive director of Food for People, explained that everyone is welcome and the goal is to support the community during this hard time.
It is a self-certification process, so we're not asking to see anyone's paperwork or EBT cards, anything like that. The idea is to help out folks impacted by the SNAP disruptions and federal workers who have been furloughed or laid off. But really, there are many folks in the community who still need a little extra assistance, so we're not going to turn anyone away.
The only caveat is that there has to be no more than 3 households per car to help manage the flow of food. The food will include non-perishables, pantry food, fresh produce, and perishables including eggs and cheese. They will have enough food to serve 1,000 households. Robbins has seen an influx of households since the shutdown started, which has led to them needing to diversify their strategies, including this emergency food drive, to keep up with the demand.
The shutdown and its impact on SNAP or CalFresh benefit here in California has been pretty huge for the clientele we serve, but also many more people in the community who don't typically access our services suddenly coming to us. Since the announcement of benefit delays was made on October 23rd, we pretty immediately saw an influx of households who were stocking up because they were scared of losing benefits. And now, you know, or a few weeks in, people are slowly starting to see their benefits come back. But the last few weeks, our demand has gone up by at least 37% for the programs that we were able to track immediately. Not all of our countywide pantries have been able to report in yet, so that figure may change, but it's been a pretty dramatic increase. We build our programs as best we can to meet capacity, but that's way beyond what we're used to. So we had to implement a bunch of different strategies, from offering a grab-and-go option in our choice pantry because we couldn't move through that many appointments at once, to bulking up other programs. And even this week, we have an emergency drive-through distribution that we'll be doing at the College of the Redwoods campus.
Food banks have had to step up in big ways to help support the community during the government shutdown. According to Robbins, there are over 30,000 people in Humboldt County relying on CalFresh benefits. All of these people who have relied on government assistance are now having to rely on food banks to support them.
The necessity really is that the volume of people impacted is dramatic. For scale, one of the stats that is important to think about is for every one meal a food bank provides, SNAP or CalFresh provides 9. So that is a huge portion of food assistance people are used to receiving that are suddenly reaching out to food banks and food pantries to try and make up the difference. So these big drive-through distributions mean we can help a lot more people in a very short period of time. So, you know, it's a full drive-through model. People drive up, we load food into cars, and then move folks along. It's helping a lot of people at once. It's a model we used in the pandemic and have used in other emergency situations, and we have found works really well.
According to their website, Food for People has been serving Humboldt County since 1979. Today, they have a giant network of support all over Humboldt County and try to help any way they can.
Food for People is a food bank serving Humboldt County, so our goal is to alleviate food insecurity and hunger across the county. We do that in a bunch of different ways. We have a network of food pantries that we provide food to and support that ranges all the way up from Oreck in the north out to Hoopa, Willow Creek, Blocksburg, Dinsmore, and all the way down to Garberville and many places in between. We also do pop-up distributions that we run in communities that need a little extra help or might not have their own food pantries. So that's going to areas like Wichipec, Orleans, and many others. We also do food programs specific to demographics that need a little bit more assistance. So those are primarily focusing on child nutrition. So we're putting together programs to aim to help children when they don't have the safety net of school meals. So that's summer and weekends. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have programs specifically supporting food and nutrition for senior populations. And we do many other things, but that's kind of the core of how we help throughout the community.
For people that want to donate or volunteer, go to foodforpeople.org. This is Gabriel Zucker, and you're listening to KMUD.
In a previous story aired last month, KMUD News spoke to a programming analyst with UC Berkeley's Safe Transportation Research and Education Center, SafeTrack, about their platform Street Story and how they work with the Coalition for Responsible Transportation Priorities, CRTP, in Humboldt County. Street Story is a platform that allows users to report potential road hazards, near crashes, and more. Since CRTP started promoting this platform for use in Humboldt County in 2019, there have now been more than 1,500 reports made. KMUD News spoke with Colin Fisk, Executive Director for CRTP, for more information on what the program does and how they work with them.
Yeah, Street Story is an online platform where anybody can report a place where they have had a crash or a near miss or where they believe there's a hazardous location. You can also report places that you think are safe on the street. And what it does is it sort of adds more information to planning and advocating for street safety improvements, because without this kind of information, really all that we have to rely on are police reports of crashes. And while that's a valuable piece of information, it kind of misses a lot. The police reports, for example, don't say anything about what the infrastructure is like in a place and how that might have contributed to a crash. And they don't know anything about near misses or, you know, places where you might expect a crash to happen in the future, but it hasn't happened yet. So this sort of supplements that information, and it provides a really great source of information and stories for CRTP to advocate for safety improvements, also for local agencies like the county and the cities and Caltrans to review when they're planning their projects and coming up with their safety improvements.
Community members can make four different kinds of reports: crash, near miss, hazard, and safe. Their maps also include crash data from the statewide Integrated Traffic Record System, SWITRS, which shows where different fatal and serious injury crashes occur, broken down into four different categories: pedestrian, bicycle, other, and pedestrian/bicycle. On the map for Humboldt County, reports are largely clustered around Broadway and Eureka, with 87 out of the approximately 246 reports made in the city. Arcata overall has approximately 80 reports, the majority of which being near misses. Ukiah comes in third with a total of 77 reports.
So we've surpassed 1,500 reports, like you said. Right now it's at 1,519, and we want people to keep using it. But also I will say that the reports aren't distributed evenly around the county. And so, you know, you can look at the reports. The reports are all publicly available. They're anonymous, but they're publicly available. And so you can see, and maybe there's a bunch of people making reports in your neighborhood or your community, and maybe there aren't. And so we would love for people in places where there aren't reports being made currently to start making those reports, so we have better information about the whole county, but also just for folks to kind of get in the habit of when they're walking down the street and they notice a hazardous condition, or when they have a near miss situation, which, you know, especially for people walking and biking, happens pretty frequently, that they just get in the habit of going on there and making a report. It just takes a couple of minutes to do, but the more information we have, the more useful it is and the more likely we are to be able to get improvements to prevent future crashes.
Street Story reports have helped inform traffic safety reports made by CRTP and is publicly available to be used for community members as well as agencies, community groups, and the media. Caltrans District 1, the City of Arcata, and the County of Humboldt also refer to Street Story reports.
I think I just want to emphasize that it's really quick and easy to make a report. It is anonymous, so you don't have to worry about, you know, your name being out there, but the reports are publicly available. So local government and CRTP use the data, but also any member of the community can use the data. So you can look and see what reports other people have made in a spot that you might be concerned about, and you can bring that forward to, say, the county or the city that you live in or Caltrans, and you can say, look, you know, the community has concerns about this. Let's do something about it. And it sort of amplifies your voice. So it's not just you saying something. You can show where the community more broadly has concerns.
For more information about Street Story, the website is streetstory.berkeley.edu. For years, groups like Friends of the Eel River and Save California Salmon have been working towards the decommission and eventual deconstruction of the Potter Valley Project's Scott and Cape Horn dams. Earlier this year, KMUD covered PG&E's moving forward with the process of surrendering its license to operate the dams, and now the process is in the stage of which the community can comment on PG&E's proposal through the Federal Regulatory Energy Commission's FERC public commenting period. The period lasts until December 1st. KMUD News spoke to Alicia Heyman, Executive Director for Friends of the Eel River, for more information about how the process has been so far.
Yeah, so for several years, PG&E has been working to prepare for the moment that we're at right now, which is that they have just submitted their final license surrender application, and the federal agency that oversees hydropower projects, which is called the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, they have just opened the public comment period on that document. So this is the public's opportunity to speak directly to the federal agency responsible for ultimately issuing a license surrender order for the Potter Valley Project.
Friends of the Eel River and Save California Salmon will be hosting meetings for interested community members to learn more about undamming the Eel River and the public comment process. The first meeting is online Wednesday, November 12th at 6 p.m., and the link can be found on the Friends of the Eel River website. Heyman elaborates more on how the public can comment.
There are a couple of ways that you can make comments. One, if you want to do it just on your own, you can go to eelriver.org. There we've got instructions for filing comments, which you can do electronically or by old-fashioned snail mail. And then we've also got suggested talking points, but we really do encourage people, you know, to speak from your heart and to really personalize your letter to this federal agency. But then if you want to write your comments in the company of others, you can join us at one of several meetings we're hosting over the next couple of weeks. First meeting is actually this Wednesday, November 12th from 6 to 7 p.m. That's going to be a virtual meeting. And you can find the link for that also at eelriver.org or on Instagram or Facebook. If you use those platforms, we are at Friends Eel River. Yeah, we've got that virtual meeting on Wednesday, November 12th from 6 to 7 p.m. And then we have several in-person meetings. There's going to be one in Eureka on Friday, November 14th at Synapsis. There's going to be one on Tuesday, November 18th in Ukiah. And there's going to be one on Friday, November 21st at the Mateel Community Center in Redway. And again, you can find information about all of those different meetings on our website, eelriver.org.
There are other meetings that are in person. There is a meeting and a dinner on Friday, November 14th from 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at Synapsis in Eureka. On Tuesday, November 18th, the Sierra Club Redwood Chapter and California Trout will be hosting a meeting in Ukiah from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. And on November 21st, from 6 to 8 p.m., there will be a meeting and dinner in Redway at the Mateel Community Center. Registration information is available online. After the public comment period, PG&E will be tasked with preparing different management plans on how dam removal will be accomplished and to take into account the effect to its natural surroundings. Heyman speaks more about the next steps.
We are going to see for the next couple of years, PG&E working to prepare various management plans, which will really provide a lot of the details of how dam removal is going to be accomplished. These management plans include things like plan for how to protect aquatic species that remain in the river during dam removal, some further sediment modeling to really understand, you know, what the composition of the sediment behind the dams is. Is it really fine stuff or is it really big, you know, giant cobbles? and then understanding how that sediment is going to move throughout the watershed. And then PG&E is also going to be preparing restoration plans. So looking at, you know, revegetating the footprint of the reservoir and making sure that they leave this landscape in much better condition than it is now. So that's going to take place over a couple of years. PG&E is anticipating that they could be finished with that process by 2028. Meanwhile, there's a separate process underway right now by the California State Water Board. They are preparing a clean water certification for dam removal. And what that means is that they're going to be looking really closely at the short-term negative impacts of dam removal. For example, that large amount of sediment that's going to move through the watershed. And they're going to help PG&E prepare to mitigate that in whatever ways that they can. The State Water Board recognizes that ultimately this project will have a net benefit. And so they will issue a clean water certification permit, but it's going to come with some conditions on how to really take good care of the river while this project is underway. And then the thing that will ultimately kick off actual physical dam removal is a license surrender order from that federal agency, from FERC. They could issue that quickly, or they could take a really long time. And that's why the public's comments showing broad support for this proposal are really, really important right now. We want to show FERC that it is in the public's best interest to decommission and remove this project as quickly as possible, not only because of the harms that it causes to the ecosystem, the risks that it poses to downstream residents because of Scott Dam's location on an earthquake fault, but also the burden that ratepayers are carrying to continue paying for this project that doesn't generate any electricity and hasn't for nearly 5 years.
For more information on Friends of the Eel River and the FERC public comment period, the website is freetheeel.org. In state news, California is sending big delegation to COP30 as federal government skips the summit. KPFA's Vic Bedoyan reports.
The United Nations Climate Conference, COP30, is currently meeting in Brazil with California and other states participating. But while the U.S. government is ignoring the conference and the reality of climate change, many nations and NGOs around the planet are taking the climate crisis seriously. Their mission is to exchange information and learn from each other. California Natural Resources Secretary Wade Crowfoot is leading California's delegation.
Part of why we're here is to share our ambitions and our progress, but drive the rest of the world forward too as a strong voice. Now this year, our federal government is totally missing in action. We may be one, if not the only national government that's not participating in this climate summit in Brazil. And the rest of the world needs to understand that America is still in this fight and we're moving forward.
The overriding goal of the climate summit is to limit the average global temperature increase below 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the 21st century. That was the target agreed to by countries around the world, including the U.S., at the climate conference in Paris in 2015. The Trump administration has since withdrawn from the agreement, but other countries took up the challenge. Jane Lomax-Smith is Lord Mayor of Adelaide in the state of South Australia. She explained to Crowfoot how they began realizing the benefits of renewable energy early on.
We were blessed about 10 years before Paris because our state government had the vision to recognize that we needed to have a stable energy supply that actually avoided any shutdowns and problems over time, but on top of that had a decarbonisation route and also was a transition to renewables. They put in legislation that was way ahead of its time. We copied California a little bit. And that legislation encouraged and changed the planning laws so that wind power was easier to install. We gave incentives across a whole range of domestic uses, and we built the very first large-scale battery in the world that could help us over the difficult periods.
Smith said the state of South Australia is getting 76% of its power from renewables, with 40% from wind. More than 50% of the houses have rooftop solar, and they expect 100% of power from renewables within 5 years. Europe is responding to climate change as well. Catatuto has the European Committee of Regions that includes more than 700 mayors and regional leaders. Europe, like California, has suffered from drought, heat waves, and wildfires. The Hungarian economist told Kofut that people today feel overwhelmed by climate crises, like they are in a constant state of emergency. Tuto said it's beyond time for just words.
You need leaders who people actually know and see and can touch and hold responsible for their words, and see that all these climate actions we are talking about, it won't cost their lives, okay? We retrofit their homes, make their cities more livable, we plant more trees. Yes, maybe we will have less cars, but public spaces will actually be connecting citizens and not divide them. We create more spaces for people to feel at home, to feel safe, because they are part of society, and we try to make it affordable.
While much attention is paid to actions of world leaders and the policies that could come out of COP30, most of the significant work is happening in meetings and workshops taking place between participants. One of them is California State Senator Josh Becker. He represents most of San Mateo County and northern Santa Clara County. He spoke with Wade Crowfoot about the value of being here.
It's really about this effort of learning from each other. And as I said, a lot of positive stories.
Yeah.
You know, with the mayor of Boise, Idaho, they have an all-electric fire station, an all-electric police station. Okay, well, yeah, I guess we can do that in my district too, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it is incredible, you know, and again, not papering over accelerating climate change. We know we have to move further and faster, but we do it together and we help each other move further and faster. So I'm with you. Like, this has been an energizing few days.
Yeah.
You know, clear-eyed about the challenges we face, but also, you know, optimistic that we're going to continue to drive forward progress.
On Thursday at COP30, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres criticized nations for their failure to limit global heat, and he added that too many corporations are making record profits from climate devastation, with billions spent on lobbying, deceiving the public, and obstructing progress. Vic Bedoyan reporting for the Pacifica Evening News and KFCF Radio.
Bay Area advocates challenge ICE courthouse arrests and conditions in holding cells after report cites abuse. KPFA's Anthony Perrazzo reports.
San Jose's U.S. District Court hearing concerned a motion for a class action lawsuit against federal immigration policies. The motion focuses on conditions at ICE's San Francisco field office at 630 Sansom Street. Jordan Wells is the senior staff attorney for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights of the San Francisco Bay Area. He details more of the problems with ICE's decision about holding cells.
This decision earlier in the summer to use temporary hold rooms for overnight and multi-night detention, where people don't have bedding, they don't have access to hygiene, they don't have access to medical care. It's causing all kinds of problems both at 630 Sansom Street and in the short-term holding cells around the country.
A recent report released by Democratic Senator John Ossoff of Georgia identified persistent problems with ICE's detention practices, including limited access to food, water, and medicine. Evidence drawn from court filings, depositions, and interviews outline the experiences of people detained by ICE. Detainees described meals too small for adults, milk that was sometimes expired, and water that smelled foul or appeared to make children sick. At one detention facility in Texas, a teenager said adults were forced to compete with children for bottles of clean water when staff left out only a few at a time. One detainee reportedly suffered a heart attack after complaining of chest pain for days without treatment. Others said inhalers and asthma medication were withheld, or that detainees waited weeks for prescriptions to be filled. Overall, the report cited more than 80 credible cases of abuse. The hearing Monday also focused on ICE's policy of making arrests at courthouses. Jordan Wells says this is unconstitutional as it violates the Fifth Amendment.
Yeah, you have people showing up who, as I said, they haven't had a criminal arrest, they haven't missed an ICE check-in, they haven't missed immigration court. They're just going through the normal procedures, and all of a sudden they are being ripped from their homes, ripped from their families, and thrust into immigration detention. And that is a violation of the Constitution's guarantee of due process under the Fifth Amendment.
Nisha Kashyap is another attorney for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights of the San Francisco Bay Area. She describes the position courthouse arrests are putting people in.
Folks who have immigration hearings are required to come to court to pursue immigration relief. If they miss court, they receive automatically an order for deportation. And by arresting people at immigration court when they come for their hearings, ICE has forced people into an impossible choice. Do I come to court to pursue my immigration case and risk arrest? Or do I miss my required court hearing and receive a deportation order?
Kashyap says the damage done to civil rights should concern citizens and non-citizens alike.
This is not something that will end or stop with non-citizens or asylum seekers. The erosion of due process, the erosion of constitutional rights, the erosion of democratic norms for those folks will affect those of us who are not in their shoes, if not now, then very soon.
The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights of the San Francisco Bay Area challenge to ICE's courthouse arrests will be heard by the court on December 9th. For KPFA News, I'm Anthony Perrazzo.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Without reliable internet, it's tough for veterans to apply for and access financial and health benefits, including mental health care. But as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, a Phoenix-based telehealth company and the Arizona Department of Veterans Services are partnering to help better equip those living on remote tribal lands.
So far, Janice Tallis Denny, who is Hopi and with the company Televeda, has delivered 16 military-grade kits containing Starlink satellite internet systems at no cost to nearly a dozen Arizona tribes beginning this year in Parker.
If I can do it, anybody can do this.
Her latest stop, New Pasqua, is just on the outskirts of Tucson.
It's a hot day today. We don't want to be out here too long.
Along with her is Dylan Delzato on behalf of the Arizona Department of Veterans Services.
Let's start with 50 of them, see where it goes, and here we are rather quickly. Excited to get the rest of them out there. And a big roadblock for a lot of vets is the internet connectivity.
Especially on tribal lands. Carmen Rivera is the Pascua Yaqui Tribe's Veterans Benefits Counselor and often travels to the Mexico border, meeting with tribal members living off-grid.
And when you give them, you know, information, whether it be off of this system or you give it to them in paper, they like that.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Oklahoma Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen is facing criticism for an exchange during a recent hearing on federal recognition for the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina. He's accused of racial stereotyping based on looks. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
Senator Mullen's an enrolled member of the Cherokee Nation, but that doesn't give him a pass with tribal leaders. During a recent hearing over whether or not to recognize the Lumbee, Mullen offended many with his exchange with Principal Chief Michelle Hicks of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indian.
You can't look over there and say they're not Native. I mean, turn around and look, and you're telling me they're not Native?
I've seen the crowd.
Okay, and you're saying that that's not Native faces?
That's not for me to determine. That's for
But we are determining it.
Nevada Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto has garnered praise across Indian country for calling Mullen out.
It's just like my frustration with this administration giving authority to ICE to pull anybody over just because they have brown skin and claim that they're undocumented somehow. I think it's wrong. I don't want to be put in a position like that.
Mullen brushes the criticism aside.
I don't care if I'm doing what is right. The Lumbees deserve to be recognized.
The 2022 Congressional Budget Office study estimated it would cost just over $90 million a year to recognize the Lumbee. Mullen says concerns raised by other tribes over the cost of enrolling the Lumbee, coupled with debates over gaming, are misguided.
I mean, I'm serious. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And if you're going to start talking about gaming, which most of these arguments are about is gaming, shame on you. Because now you're putting profit over Native people.
Well, North Carolina's two Republican U.S. senators are pushing the Lumbee Fairness Act, which would recognize the tribe federally, Senator Cortez Masto says that's a decision best left up to nonpartisan officials within the Interior Department.
I am not equipped to make that determination, and that's why that was set up that way. It's evidence-based. I rely on it.
President Donald Trump has promised the Lumbee federal recognition. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Gabriel Zucker, Vic Bedoyan, Anthony Perrazzo, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMA News is online, and you can find us on KMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.